the population as a whole, if we can improve health, age, average age length in good health, our productivity improves, cost to the community is immense eventually. So we think that we're now pretty good. We're in the top six of the OECD countries in terms of life expectancy. Why don't we have a crack at becoming number one? And that's a pretty good challenge to go for.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Welcome back for our first podcast of 2018. When Malcolm Turnbull became Prime Minister, he talked up innovation, and the government quickly produced a policy statement with a range of incentives and other initiatives. But somehow the concept doesn't seem to have got as much traction as was hoped. Today we're speaking with the Chair of Innovation and Science Australia, Bill Ferris, whose board provides independent advice to government on science, research and innovation issues. This week, the board launched a report setting out a blueprint for Australia to be in the top tier of innovation nations by 2030. Bill Ferris, can we start with why the government's innovation focus doesn't seem to have taken off better?
Well, Michelle, thank you for having me on your broadcast. And let me say that the NISA initiative to which you refer, when the Prime Minister was on this topic at the start, has had some traction that people perhaps aren't recognising. For example, in this country, venture capital, or the lack of supply of venture capital, has been something of a handbrake on the ability of this country to commercialise more of its own ideas. In fact, in the 2 years from the announcement to last year, the venture capital supply has increased by something like 400% on the back of tax legislating changes for high net worth investors and for the early stage venture capital limited partnership structures, and with the formation of a biomedical translation fund, a 500 million pool of venture capital, which the government led with a 250 million lead investment and has been matched by, encouragingly, our superannuation funds in this country. So for the first time, they're showing some movement on a traditional risk aversion and providing institutional money for support of venture capital activity. So here are some of the things that aren't normally commented upon, perhaps. And so it has been a good start. Having said that, the through line that you're drawing out is that the initial enthusiasm, when tested in the marketplace of an electoral reality mid-last year, whenever it was clear that the feedback to politicians was innovation didn't necessarily play that well in a lot of postcodes.
But if things are happening, perhaps that doesn't matter all that much.
Well, there's some truth in that. But I think that, for galvanising and mobilising the politics and the entire nation about the importance of innovation and a very big increase in innovation we need to get a sustainable prosperity for this country, that needs to be widely understood so that it can be rolled out and it can be politically, bipartisanly supported.
Well, one factor in that perhaps is having a strong ministerial voice talking about how this is important and what's been done. And yet, in a very short time, you've had ministers chopping and changing. You've had, five ministers in the area, is that right?
Well, aren't we popular? But certainly Michaelia Cash now.
That's one way of looking at it.
And Craig Laundy, Arthur Sinodinos, and Greg Hunt and Christopher Pyne. All good people. Look, we'd be...
But briefly passing by.
Passing through. Look, I think we lose some continuity, clearly, and depth of domain knowledge in that amount of churn. We do pick up some diversity and some ownership and support in cabinet that's wider than might have otherwise been. So, a bit of this, a bit of that.
All right, let's now turn to the innovation blueprint that's come out this week. That plan focuses on five key areas: education, industry, how government can be a catalyst for change, research and development, and what you dub culture and ambition. So let's go through these. You make the point on education that just when Australia has to speed up its innovation performance, the results of our children in science, maths, literacy have declined in the last decade, although of course school funding has increased. Now, governments always talk about the need for better teaching, more resources, but where do the problems actually lie? Is it funding, inequities in the school system, a lack of commitment by governments, or indeed by parents or students? You speak about the need for raising children's ambitions in literacy and numeracy. And also, to what extent is it less a matter of Australia falling behind than other countries striding out faster?
Well, the complexity of your question, the depth of it, explains the complexity of any solutions here. But let's start with this. We, as a board, recognised pretty early on as we began to pull together what would it take to propel, to turbocharge innovation. We quickly landed on the fact that unless we could get an education system that could equip kids by 2030 with the skills they need to get a job and keep a job and do a job and be innovative, unless we could get the education that would run that, we could probably put our pens down on the rest of the task. You know, it's that fundamental. So we focused really on secondary schools and the vocational education training between school and university, or tertiary education per se. Look, I think, Michelle, all the issues you mentioned, teacher quality, student performance, the downward trend in the PISA comps with other nations, is I've referred to it as a, you know, if you wanted to find the canary in the mine shaft, this is not a chirp, it's a clarion call for change. Because science, technology, maths, engineering, literacy, all those graphs of student performance have declined, as you say, in 10 years, in spite of increased education per student. Thank you, Gonski, thank you, government. So I don't think it's so much a question of funding as it is in quality of teaching, curricular focus, and student performance being motivated with a mindset of what's possible and why they should bother with subjects like STEM. And so one of the recommendations, in a granular sense, is support for the what's called the STEM Partnership Forum. And this is industry, a group of industry and educators getting together to improve how they make students, secondary school students in particular, more aware and more understanding of why these subjects are so important for future careers. So it is a mix, a cocktail of things that has to be addressed.
But how do you actually motivate students compared to other countries where there's obviously a greater commitment at the moment, really, to learning and being competitive in learning?
Well, you would know, and I certainly remember, the impact of a teacher can be enormous, and still is, in the classroom. So it can often start, the answer to that question, with a great teacher. Now, you can't guarantee all that so universally and ubiquitously across the school system, but we need a heap more of that. We also need parents to be aware and interested, and we need industry to do more than they currently are, and they're actually increasing their programs with the school system to give examples of what students can aspire to, where they could look to work, and why the subjects we're talking about. And it's not just STEM, of course, not just the science courses and the math courses, it's a mix of everything. But in particular, it's clear that in the digital economy we are in now and moving rapidly into, most jobs by 2030 will require some skills, some digital literacy that the kids currently aren't getting.
Now, you also deal with the question of vocational education, and there's been increasing concern that this is for too long been treated as inferior to universities and has fallen behind our needs. What do you think should be done there? What does the blueprint think should be done?
Yeah, this is a really important question. I mean, when I go back to our panel's deliberations about what's the vision we have for the country It was to have, and is to have, a country known and respected for the quality of its, for the excellence of its research, its science, its commercialization of that, with meaningful and plentiful jobs in what we want to see as a fair, inclusive and healthy society. Now, I go back to that because there will be transition of jobs, there will be job losses, there'll be job changes, and for sure, to cope equitably and fairly and constructively with all of that, you need to be able to skill and reskill students, workers, older people, everybody in their longer working lives. And the role, therefore, for a vocational education training sector that is fully equipped, highly reputable, interfacing with higher ed, cleverly, that we should have, we currently don't have, and therefore we've called for a review of the VET sector as an urgent requirement.
Has one of the problems here been that there's a bit of educational snobbery involved, that people feel their kids really should go to university, that somehow if you go to a TAFE, that's too low down the totem pole?
I do think that. It's interesting you ask that, because the equivalent, in the UK, they've been successfully experimenting with degrees in TAFE-like colleges in the VET sector.
But that's just playing to the snobbery, isn't it?
Not if the qualifications, as they seem to be, do correlate with jobs and stature and so on. It's not just tokenism. But I don't take that as a major. I actually think that young people are interested. I mean, whether it's about plumbing or electricians or whatever, we're actually contemplating a wide range of skills and digital skills and hands-on skills that companies and big and small need a heap more of, and where there'll be a heap more of jobs. So it is addressing the jobs-ready sort of configuration of what you need in a whole education sector. Snobbery in the past, without a question, has caused parents to insist their kids go to university, without a question. And I'm not against kids going to university, but I am very keen for kids to be given real opportunities straight out of school into VET if they choose. And as I said before, Michelle, the whole reskilling capability for VET is the big thing, where it's going to be really loaded up over the next couple of decades.
On the other hand, as part of this debate, could you think that a realignment between people going to university, people going to the VET system, might reduce our ability to boost innovation, because the universities are probably greater drivers of innovation through research and so on? Yeah,
well, firstly, they are great producers of new ideas and intellectual property. And the last thing I would want, and my panel, my ISA people would ever want, would be to kill that golden goose of knowledge creation. We're excellent at it. We ain't excellent at translating and commercializing that. And partly that is because of the insufficient amount of collaboration between industry, business and entrepreneurs with universities. There's the silo of academia, there's the silo of business, to sort of use that expression a bit loosely. I think the better and continuous link you have with engineering, science, electrical, material science skills through the VET sector, there's no way we'll dilute the ability. We will expand the ability to translate and commercialize. I don't think it's going to dilute the basic science and the basic research that the universities and others are doing.
Just to take up your golden goose point before we move on, do you think that the government is squeezing the university's funding too much?
Look, it's the question that we're receiving. I don't want to see the universities unnecessarily squeezed, that's for sure. I think the job they've done in the overseas students recruitment and training areas is spectacular. And of course, a lot of the revenues from that success have been channeled into, and some would say diverted into, research and that whole basic science area. I think overall the universities are doing a great job. I think they're reasonably funded, and I'm optimistic because where the through line, which I know we'll come to, is we're looking for industry to do a lot more with the universities. I'm looking for the industry to spend more money with the universities and the universities to reach out and engage with industry. So it's not just about government funding, it is about industry funding as well.
Now, just on industry, the board's report urges a rebalancing over time from indirect tax-based incentives to more direct support. In this context, what do you think of the government's announcement this week to boost access to finance for Australia's defence export industry?
Okay, well, if I could first just address the direct and indirect issue. It turns out that the business incentives provided by government in Australia are overwhelmingly via indirect tax measures, the what's called the RDTI, the Research and Development Tax Incentive, which represents 85% of all incentives.
Just explain indirect in this context.
Okay, well, it's open to all claimants. It's agnostic as to industry or purpose, other than the test of original R&D expenditure. So it's open access, agnostic, etc. And we've found that to be a ratio quite out of step with most of our innovation competitors that are beating us hands down at the moment. So for example, Sweden and Israel and various other countries have 100% of their incentives direct, zero indirect. America has 73% direct, UK about 50-50. So we're not saying we want to get rid of our indirect scheme, but we do want to over time rebalance and utilize incremental and more direct grants programs, co-investment programs, things like the Export Market Development Grants Program to push exports faster and harder, because exports are a great proxy for competitiveness and for innovation activity. So there are a lot of things we'd want to rebalance over time. On the question of the new proposed funding for defence exports, look, you know, we do, as I said, we like exports as a proxy for innovation activity. I haven't read the great detail of that proposal, but I think the likely success for defence exports would be not just for defence forces offshore, but for civil purposes and civil uses offshore. And the ones that would be sustainable are those that really are based on an innovative, novel-to-marketplace product. So we do have some of that. We've got aluminium ships that go fast. We've got the Nulka decoys. We've got the Bushmaster, very modern land-based vehicles. We've got the whole sonar products range now made in this country and exported. Those sorts of things, I think, can realistically be pushed harder. And the schemes would appear to be based on the fact that in tender processes around the world, if you've got to support a tender with a loan content to fund the export, and the test is you mightn't be able to get that from the banking system, then this program would come into place. So it's time will tell, like most things, but I think it's got some merit.
Are the risks, I suppose, for the taxpayers in governments trying to pick winners, or when it comes to innovation, do you have to pick winners? Do you have to just take those risks?
Well, there's no doubt ultimately the marketplace pretty quickly determines what's a winner and what's a loser. I think what our direction on rebalancing of incentives and so on is certainly not about picking individual companies, but it is about backing sectors that we see as already competitively poised and based and resourced, and not running down dead alleys with limited funds. So we're unashamedly wanting to run with the best competitively based sectors. We're not singling out individual executives or their companies in our set of recommendations.
Although that can be a consequence, of course.
Well, you'd hope so.
That you're in the sense that individual companies.
We would expect within these competitive sectors we have, and we do, and the government's and I think it is reasonably nowadays bipartisan support for the reality that we have sectors like the health and medical research sector and like advanced manufacturing now emerging, where there's bipartisan recognition for that, bipartisan support, and where we want to build on and in particular ensure that they have a real crack at the export markets, not just the domestic markets.
Now, in terms of what government can do, you do suggest that the public service adopt a more cross-agency approach to work to improve policy development and delivery. Do you think that there is a serious problem of a silo culture at the moment within government?
I think there's a serious slowdown in policy development and implementation through that reality. I mean, my board was mandated to come up with this, among other things, to come up with a strategic plan and to take a whole of government view of existing programs and to provide advice about the evaluation of those programs, etc. And so I have seen the silos. I have seen the lack of whole of government approach on some of these things. So it's not broke, but it could be a lot better. And the answer is yes.
Now, you've talked about commercialisation of research results. We do seem to have heard for eons the message that we don't adequately commercialise our research and development. Mm. And I remember this through successive governments and initiatives have been produced. But have we improved at all in this area? And again, what are the blockages?
The good news is we are improving. I think even if you compare the numbers to 5 years ago, one of the big blockages has been, understandably, that our researchers are rewarded for the quality of their research. Tick that box. But that means public citations of work and publications. It does not have anything to do historically with marketplace reality or translation of the research into business or elsewhere. So the move by the government a few years ago, and now we're piloting this during 2017 and into this year, a requirement, a new criteria, an additional criteria in the way research funds are allocated to universities. A new block grants structure whereby industry engagement becomes an important criterion. And so this will drive, and is already driving, behavioural response in the universities from the vice chancellors down. They get it. They understand that. Governments, taxpayers, stakeholders are expecting more of this intellectual property to find its way into the marketplace. So they have to drive more closely with industry and vice versa. So that's on the go, and that's an important new thing. We're complementing that with a particular recommendation to add a collaboration premium into the way the research and development tax incentive works. So this is a carrot, not a stick, and it says to industry, if you're prepared to spend more time, more money, employ more PhDs into industry. We've got a very, very low PhD recruitment engagement ratio in this country compared to the rest of the world.
In a way, you could say this is a very utilitarian approach, isn't it? But
meaning practical?
Yes, meaning practical, meaning structured. Yet if you look at some of the big breakthroughs that have come, say, in Australian medical science, were they in fact in that sort of context, or were they more in a pure, somewhat disengaged context?
Well, look, currently I think, and I can go back on this, I think currently the problem we've had in health and medical research, in fact, has been great knowledge creation, great ideas, and no money from venture capital or industry, relatively speaking, to put some of this stuff through clinical trials in Australia before you can get to the marketplace. So we think we're solving that. I think when you look back at some of the breakthroughs, often the ear implant product, the Cochlear, the ResMed sleep apnea product, often these two companies are talked about as great examples of medical device work. You know, they did enjoy government incentives and did utilise them. And they did use, in both cases, start with academic breakthroughs and then commercialise. So there are stories, and we just know heaps more like that. And there are a lot more, Michelle, now.
One of the most interesting aspects of the plan is its advocacy of large-scale initiatives. Now, you told the press club, and I quote your words, "Where I see a big gap between Australia and the world's leading innovation nations is in the level of our aspiration and our willingness to tackle big problems at a global scale. Your blueprint recommends a national mission," you call it, you use the word mission, "to use genomics and precision medicine to assist Australia in becoming the healthiest nation on Earth. It also suggests other missions, such as saving the Great Barrier Reef." Can you just give us a flavour of some of the detail here?
Certainly. And you know, it's not that Australia hasn't had some of these high-impact projects, call them missions. Some would call them moonshots. The Snowy Hydro Scheme, the Square Kilometre Array Telescope, currently the quantum computing pursuit, where our new Australian of the Year, Michelle Simmons, running a team. Yes, look, the detail on the genomics and precision medicine, this is the whole fantastic new revolution of that will impact medical care and analysis and diagnosis and so on. And we think and believe that the capability, we have some now, but if we can build it and integrate fully a genomics and precision medicine capability into the healthcare system, we will, over time, that will enable us to add enormous benefits to the community.
You told a very moving story about a little boy and the way the medical science was able to help him in a very critical situation and quickly.
What I didn't talk about on that description is, and you remind me to, you know, this little kid, he's 7 years of age, he'd been through years of unrelenting, sequential new scans, new ideas, new therapies, new trials, new shotguns, and none of them worked. And this is one kid's story, but
they didn't know what was wrong with him.
No, that's right. Now, you know, the Garvan Institute in Sydney has set up a genomics sequencing trial program for people with rare diseases. Mm. Turns out rare diseases aren't quite so rare when you look at the stats. But anyway, little Adam, he came in, he was critically ill in hospital. They sequenced his genome, identified a weird variation. Over a weekend, researched the literature and found a drug that dealt with that in the USA with people with a few people with the same variation. Within 1 week, Adam was out of danger. Within 6 months, he went to school for the first time, and now he rides a bike like all the other kids. So it's a great story, but what it masks is the savings, actually. If he could have avoided, had he been able to avoid all the blood tests, all the scans, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, the cost to the health system is an issue. As importantly, more importantly, is the prospect for the health outcome for these kids. And for the population as a whole, if we can improve health, age, average age length in good health, our productivity improves, cost to the community is immense eventually. So we think that we're now pretty good. We're in the top six of the OECD countries in terms of life expectancy. Why don't we have a crack at becoming number one? And that's a pretty good challenge to go for. And wouldn't the world notice us too?
And on the very different subject of the reef.
Oh, the reef.
What's the mission
there? Well, you know, I personally think this is a very, very important thing for all Australians. So, you know, a definition of a national mission, by the way, is something that's almost impossible, relevant to all Australians, high impact, coalescing great science and innovation to demonstrate what's possible. You know, we're trying to achieve those sorts of things. So the reef, Australia has been investing in the future of the reef, mainly in terms of trying to deal with the crown of thorns degradation and degradation through runoffs from land use up and down the Queensland coast primarily. And so they should, and so we should keep doing so. But the reality is, in the last 3 years, half the coral has died from bleaching. The bleaching isn't caused by crown of thorns or runoffs. It's caused by warming waters, and it's caused by the acidification as well that comes with that. And, you know, we're dealing with this iconic reef structure and habitat that the experts are now believing is half dead. So what we're challenging in this mission is, can you come up with a restoration adaptation type set of interventions, engineering and eco and biosystem possible interventions to increase the chances, no guarantees here, but increase the chances that we can extend the life of and protect this reef beyond 2030.
Do you think you can get government support to embrace this, these big ideas, this mission approach? Have you had any feedback on that?
Yeah, I do think we will. I think leaders get it. And I think last week we were pleased that the government actually did approve the funding for the feasibility project definition phase of the reef mission. So we're pleased with that. It gets it underway. But ultimately, of course, that's a big spend over a long period of years. On the genomics and precision medicine, I've seen the Minister for Health, Greg Hunt, and Department of Health have worked this program up really well in alignment with us. The ACOLA, the Australian Academy of Learned Academics, today came out with their evidence-based learned position and statement about the importance of this genomics and precision medicine pursuit. And we have in this country the Medical Research Future Fund now, which is on its way to becoming ultimately a $20 billion endowment. It's now already something like $7 billion, maybe more. And so the funding for this, I hope, is pretty clearly going to involve the MRFF. We've said in our report initially a $200 million style kickoff, so you can sequence cohorts of people with cancer, cohorts of people with rare disease, cohorts of people with all sorts of chronic disease, and gather the information that can be helpful and added to the other phenotypical input we get from the clinicians and the physician. Pull that all together and you'll get a great outcome eventually on this. So, yes, I think there'll be a good response.
Well, especially in an election run-up, politicians are always in the market for big ideas, good ideas, so good luck with them.
Well, Michelle, that's your experience and observations. I don't doubt they're right. I just think these missions are timeless in this sense that they'll run through multiple election phases, and they need probably to have good bipartisan support to get up. But they need to get up. They'll get up.
Bill Ferris, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all for our Conversations Politics podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage, and we'll be back with another interview soon.